Okay, so this talk emanates from a joint paper by me and David Brad Mitchell, who's buggered off and consequently isn't here to field questions. In a way, it's a paper about whether we should be ontologically committed to wholes, and if so, what they are. But it's also a paper about the methodology of a priori metaphysics. And in a way, we want to go some way towards defending a particular methodology by engaging in some. And hopefully that engagement will sort of reveal the methodology, and its fantastic results will give you reason to think that it's a great thing. So metaphysics is by and large done a priori, albeit that it's sensitive to the findings of the various physical sciences. But often what the physical sciences tell us underdetermines what we should think about the metaphysics of our own and other possible worlds. So I think it's widely agreed these days that what we should say about the nature of wholes depends on what we should say about the nature of space. But of course, the issue of what we should say about the nature of space is itself a deeply controversial matter. So, so the overview of the paper is like this. I'll start off by talking a little bit about a priori metaphysics and the way we see this methodology. That'll give you a bit of a background, a quick cook's tour through three different analyses of wholes as they stand in the literature. Then I'll talk a bit about some different accounts of space, and I'll race through a couple of these, and I'll try and focus on just a couple. And it's those couple that I'll focus on that we'll take through into the next section. And what we're going to do is evaluate these analyses in the light of these different suppositions that we'll go into about the nature of space. And in the light of these kind of implications for these analyses, we'll then move on to the final section where I'll offer you a new analysis of this idea of a whole. Okay. So a priori metaphysics as... Boy, that's way up there. As we see it, is largely the process of constructing what I'll call conceptual maps. And these maps tell us what to say about the referent of some term given various different suppositions about the referent of some other term. So in this case, what should we say about wholes given different suppositions about what we should say about the nature of space. So what we want to do is think about a range of different accounts of the way space could be. And then we want to think about what wholes would be under these various different suppositions. So the process of constructing a conceptual map is not the process of constructing some map of logical space, because some of the suppositions about space will be ones according to which space is one way necessarily so, other suppositions will be ones according to which space is a different way necessarily so, and some of them will be ones according to which space is some ways in one world, other ways in different worlds. So some of the suppositions almost certainly will effectively be counter-possibles. And the conceptual map you end up with, therefore, won't be a map of logical space, rather some proper part of it will be logical space and the rest won't. We think that conceptual maps are important precisely because often we don't know which part of them represents logical space. Because there are various metaphysical claims, the answers to which we don't know whether the claim is necessarily true, necessarily false, or contingently true or false. In this case, that's mostly going to be these accounts of the nature of space. And essentially what the conceptual map tells you are a bunch of conditional claims. So it tells you if it turns out that this part of the map is logical space, then this is what the analysis is, and this is what it will turn out that the extension of the terms are. This is what it turns out that wholes are. And it may even be sensitive not just to which part of logical space, but to which world is the actual world in that part. Or if it turns out that where logical space is located over here in our conceptual map, then this is what wholes turn out to be, and this is how the analysis goes. So we also think that conceptual maps are not just important because you don't know which part of the map is genuinely logical space, but because they tell us something sort of important about our concepts. You might not think that what they give us is content. You might be wedded to a kind of traditional possible worlds account of content, but it does seem like they shed some kind of important light on your concepts. So it seems like a perfectly sensible question to ask, if space were substantival in some way and necessarily so, what would the nature of holes be? And that seems like a perfectly sensible question with what we might all agree on is a perfectly sensible answer, even if in fact we all thought that relationism was true and necessarily so. And it seems like something about the nature of our concept of whole is giving us some indication of what we should say about these substantival worlds. Now, this is not to say that by putting forward this idea of conceptual maps, we want to say that there are impossible worlds, or that we want to defend a kind of inflationary account of hyperintentionality, according to which there's genuinely different content in common between necessarily true and maybe even necessarily false propositions. These would be kind of additional commitments to which one may or may not want to buy in. We just want to make the claim that a priori metaphysics is essentially involved the business of kind of constructing these conceptual maps, these conditional claims about what would be the case given other things. And in a sense, that's all you can do a priori. Right. Okay. Holes. So there are basically three different, what you might think of, analyses of the idea of a hole in the literature. So we start off with very deflationary accounts, which identify holes with some kind of part or surface of ordinary material objects. The Lewisian account is the best exemplar of this kind. You identify holes with a particular surface of a material thing, namely what we would typically think of as the hole lining, where we don't think of the hole as being the surface, right? The advantage of the Lewisian account is that it's perfectly ontologically kind of parsimonious. You're not committed to anything you weren't already, and you're not committed to anything kind of odd or recherché. The disadvantage is that holes turn out to be radically different from what you might have thought. You don't get to keep most of your intuitions about their locations and their dimensions and their properties. So it was in the light of the fact that it does such violence to our intuitions about holes that Vasi and Cassati came up with their alternative analysis, according to which holes are located roughly where we think they are with roughly the dimensions we think they have and most of the properties. And on their view, holes turn out to be immaterial beings. A particular kind of immaterial being, namely one that has a certain kind of topology and relational property. But of course, this meant that they were then left with this thing, immaterial being, to explain. And the explanation was, well, what we should think is that worlds are composed of space. And space can be qualified, can have properties in various locations, or it can be unqualified, it can be kind of bare and have no properties. And we should identify material things with regions of qualified space and immaterial things with regions of unqualified space, and holes are particular immaterial things. And so since space is a perfectly fine thing to be committed to, we have no problem here. We have a perfectly good account. And the third account is due to a previous temporal slice of mine, which was on board with Vasi and Cassati when they said that we should be identifying holes with things which roughly have the kind of properties we think they do and are located roughly where we think they are, but thought that introducing this idea of an immaterial being was a little dodgy. And in part it was motivated by the idea that it turns out that in our world there is no unqualified space, at least given what physics currently tells us. So if holes just were unqualified space, it looks like A, there wouldn't be any, and B, it looks like we don't need to appeal to these immaterial beings, right? Pretty much any region that you choose in our world will be filled with some kind of material thing, well, filled with matter at any rate, and it seems like it's not a big jump to then say it's filled with some kind of material entity, and that thing has exactly the dimensions and the properties that we want to attribute to the hole, so why not just identify that thing with the hole? Why do we need this talk of immaterial beings? Okay. So at this point, Vasi and Cassati had a response to this, what we'll call the material beings view, which was, look, even if it turns out that all the space in our world is qualified, all that tells us is that contingently in our world, all your holes are occupied. Doesn't mean we should be identifying the holes with the occupants. After all, surely our world could have been such that there was no matter in the relevant region where the hole is, right? So we shouldn't be identifying the hole with the occupant. Put very roughly, then, you might think that the debate comes down to this. First, the question, are worlds composed of space in the first place? And second, if they are, is that space such that we could remove its qualities and be left with the same unqualified space? Okay. And clearly, to resolve that issue, we need to know a bit more about space in general. So, accounts of space. Roughly, of course, accounts of space fall into two categories. As everyone knows, substantivalism, the view that space is a real thing or substance, And relationism, the view that it's not a real thing or substance. All that exists are objects and events and primitive spatial and temporal relations that hold between them. So relations only exist between objects and events, whereas substantivalists think that relations hold between objects and space itself. Relationism, in turn, then subdivides into various kinds, of which there are two notable ones, actualist and modal, where, roughly speaking, actualists are only going to appeal to actual objects and relations, whereas modalists want to appeal to both actual objects and relations and possible objects and possible relations. And you can already see how this is going to come apart, because actualists are only going to be able to talk about locations at which some object exists, whereas modalists can talk about unoccupied locations. So primarily, given that we're going to focus on two different accounts, one version of relationism and one version of substantivalism. And the version of relationism we're going to concentrate on is the actualist version. So, a little more carefully, actualist relationism is true to a world just in case all the spatial properties and relations in that world are properties of or relations between objects in the world. And there exists a location in that world just if there exists some object at that location, which may or may not be entailed by A. If anyone has any views, feel free to pipe up. Okay, so for the actualist, literally nothing exists between objects. There's merely the holding of some non-zero distance relation. To talk about a location at which no object exists is at very best to say, had an object existed there, then there would have existed a location, right? Whereas the modal relationist doesn't have that problem. Okay, substantivalism is roughly the view that space exists independently of the objects that are located in it, and it's in virtue of being related to a particular region of space that an object is located where it is. So it's sort of unsurprising that metaphysical accounts of the nature of space have been structured quite a lot by various different theories about space that have been given to us by physical theory in some sense. So from Newtonianism through neo-Newtonianism through to general theory of relativity, you get a picture which is similar in its kind of foundations. So basically, you begin by positing a set of continuous points. Then you add in a topology, and once you've got your topology, you've got a manifold. That is, a manifold just is a set of continuous points with a particular topology. Then you add in a geometry by specifying a metric, where the metric tells you the distances between the points. And then you play around a bit and you add in some matter and fields and all the funky stuff, right? And so if we look at our world, supposing general theory of relativity is true, they're defined in terms of this triple of M, G and T, where M represents the manifold. In this case, it's a four-dimensional manifold of continuum points. G represents the metric, which defines the relations among the points. In this case, it includes stuff about the gravitational field. And T is the stress energy tensor, which represents the distribution of matter and energy. And then what happens is philosophers come along and they look at this M, G and T and they think to themselves, yeah, but where's the space in all this, mate? Right. And then they identify space with some combination of M, G and T. So manifold substantivalists identify space with M, the manifold. Metric field substantivalists identify it with the manifold and the metric, M plus G, and tensor field substantivalists, as I'm calling them, I don't think they actually have a name, identify space with M, G and T, the manifold, the metric and the matter energy field. So the idea is they identify actual space with those things, and then, so if you're a manifold substantivalist, you think that in other worlds the space there is identical to a particular array of points with a particular topology. Of course, the points will be numerically distinct from our points and the topology will be different, but nevertheless the space will be a manifold, and likewise for the other views. And the view that I'll be talking most about today is metric field substantivalism, where metric field substantivalism is true at a world just in case the substantival space in the world, and that space is identical to a collection of continuous points with a particular topology, namely a manifold, and a metric G, such that for each point, the relational properties of that point conferred by the metric are essential properties of the point. Now, this is the most common version of metric field substantivalism, and it does in fact go beyond the claim that your space is simply identical to your manifold and your metric. And there are various reasons people do this. They do it primarily because they don't want people shuffling the points around and keeping the same space for various reasons to do with the whole argument, rather ironically, given the concept of this particular talk. So this is a stronger claim. It claims that the actual relational properties of all of the points are essential properties of them. So you can't go messing around with your point distribution. Okay. So when we're trying to answer the question, what is the nature of space, one question we have to ask ourselves is, what is the modality attaching to the answer that we want to give? So we might be necessitarians. We might think that our preferred account of the nature of space is true and necessarily so. Or we might be some kind of contingentist. We might think that there are worlds in which some accounts of space hold and other worlds in which different accounts of space hold. And of course, there are various ways you might be a contingentist. You might not think that all of these different accounts of space hold in some world. You might, as long as you think that some of them hold in different worlds. But for the moment, by contingentism, I'm going to intend a kind of strong contingentism, which is the claim that for each of these different accounts, there is a world where that account is true. And we'll come back to what I mean by that in a moment. So at least in the methodology is that we want to consider each of these analyses in the light of each of the different suppositions about the way the nature of space is. That's not because we think that, in fact, this kind of strong contingentism is by any means the most plausible view about what the structure of logical space actually is, but rather that we want to evaluate these analyses of whole. And because the concept of whole is sensitive to what the nature of space is, we want to evaluate the analyses under the broadest range of possible different suppositions about the way space could be. Now, at this point, you might object. You might say, look, suppose I think that space is one way necessarily so, and I have my preferred analysis of whole, and I take my analysis to my worlds, and in that cluster of worlds where I think space is one way, my analysis correctly identifies all the wholes in those worlds, right? So why isn't that good enough? Why should I care? You come and you tell me there's some other world which I take to be impossible, and you tell me that in that world my analysis doesn't do so well. And I say, well, so what? It's not a possible world. I can't do everything. But our view is, look, issues to do with the nature of space are incredibly controversial. And you may think that your view is true and necessarily so, but you should give reasonable credence to either being mistaken about some of the details about what the nature of space is, or mistaken as to the modality of the view. And in fact, you should give quite reasonable credence to this. So you should think, you should give credence to some alternative account about the nature of space being true. And you should then be worried if it turns out that your analysis of what it is to be a whole would render wholes eliminated or misidentify them if it turned out that account were true. Of course, you shouldn't be surprised if wholes turn out to be something other than what you thought they were if that account should turn out to be true, because you think that account is false. But you should be worried if the actual analysis of your concept would misidentify the wholes. Okay, so what we want to do, the general structure of the paper is to consider each of these analyses in the light of all of the different suppositions about the nature of space. So it's as though we're pretending contingentism were true. In this talk, we'll only focus on the two accounts. For simplicity, I just express this in terms of the locution of considering a world at which the hypothesis is true. Now, of course, if you're a contingentist, you think that that's a possible world. So that's just fine. You can just read it as possible world talk. If you're a necessitarian, then you might well think it's not a possible world. So you should read this as me considering some epistemically possible world. Namely, you're considering what you would say about that world if you were to discover, contrary to expectation, that your view about what's necessarily true isn't, and that the world in question is possible. Okay. Okay, so we're going to consider actualist relationism and metric field substantivalism. Right, so we're going to consider some world where relationism is true, in particular actualist relationism is true in this world W1. And we want to draw a distinction at this point between plenum and non-plenum worlds. The distinction is incredibly intuitive. Plenum worlds are just worlds where every region is occupied by matter of some kind. Non-plenum worlds are worlds where you have unoccupied regions. The idea is very straightforward. It's completely straightforward if you're a substantivalist, but it's very difficult, or rather more difficult to define if you're a relationist. So the definition of non-plenum there is supposed to be neutral between substantivalism and relationism, but it's there more for edification than illumination. If you want to know what non-plenum means, just think of it as, you know, a world with unoccupied regions. Then, in non-plenum worlds, the regions where you would pre-theoretically suppose there's a hole might be wholly occupied by matter, partially occupied by matter, or not occupied at all. And corresponding to those, you'll get different kinds of holes. So you might have, on the one hand, occupied holes, which are ones that, according to your pre-theoretic judgments as to their location, are wholly occupied by matter, and unoccupied holes, which are ones that, according to your judgments as to their location, are completely unoccupied by matter. Once again, the distinction is incredibly easy to draw if you're a substantivalist, not so much if you're an actualist, because, again, it looks like you're going to have to appeal to some kind of unoccupied location. We do try and go some way towards defining these ideas, the unoccupied whole for the relationist. I think ultimately it fails, but it's interesting to see why it fails, which is as follows. So we have some whole, namely some unoccupied whole in this non-plenum world, and here we have this hideous definition of what seems like a perfectly straightforward idea, a whole with nothing in it, for God's sake. And we have to appeal to this idea of a hole opening, which is the bit across the top, the kind of boundary of the hole, which is not also a boundary to the object that has the hole. And the idea is you take a point on any of the boundary of the what is both the hole and the object, take any point, head off in a direction, and the first thing that you run into is the object in which the hole is there, so is in. So you don't run into anything else because there's nothing in the hole, right? So you can see this more clearly with this terrible diagram. Just forget the gravel. I think it's a diagram of how to put in pillars if you're building a fence, but it's the best I could do with Google Image. So the gravel really shouldn't be there because it's just making life much more complex. But this is our unoccupied hole minus the gravel, which kind of occupies some of it. But you could think of the hole as from the gravel up. And don't be laughing at my diagrams. Okay, so the whole the whole opening is supposed to be, if this pointed, I would point, but it doesn't point, the bit across the top, which is supposed to be the top boundary of the whole. And the idea is take any point on the whole lining, which is also part of the object, head off in any direction, and the first thing you run into with inside the whole opening is the object itself that has the whole. There's nothing else to run into. Okay, so what are we going to say about holes like this in our actualist world? Well, it looks like both the immaterial beings and the material beings' view are going to make us eliminativists about this whole, because it's an actualist world, so there is no space in this world, so there are no immaterial beings, and there's no material being either. At least there's no material being that occupies the right region, given what the material beings' view tells us about wholes. So both of those views make us eliminativists. It seems like the right view in this world is the Lewisian view, which identifies the whole with the whole lining itself and gets to say that there's a whole. So strictly speaking, we might say that this makes talk about unoccupied wholes in these worlds a bit misleading, because it's not like you have a whole with certain dimensions and then lo, it just turns out to be unoccupied. The whole just turns out to be the whole lining itself. But if actualist relationalism is true, that doesn't really turn out to be very surprising, because even our attempts to define this idea of an unoccupied whole were rather dodgy. After all, we appeal to this idea of a hole opening at the top there. But it seems like to appeal to that, you need to be able to talk about the points or the locations where that boundary would be, but there's nothing there. So if you're an actualist, there are no such points, there are no such locations. And indeed, talk about the unoccupied hole doesn't make much sense, because there is no location at which we would pre-theoretically say the hole exists, because the location isn't there, because there's no stuff there. Right, so no location. So strictly speaking, we should probably say that while there are holes in such world, they're not unoccupied holes. But we'll continue to use the locution because it works. The image is very clear and it works in all the other worlds. So the point is that on pain of elimination, the Lewisian account is victorious in this case. Okay, so let's move on to consider another world close by, also actionless relationist world, but this is a plenum world. So all of its regions are occupied. Ergo, not surprisingly, its holes are occupied. So what do we say about some hole in this world? Well, it looks like in this world, the Lewisian analysis and the immaterial beings analysis are the ones that fall on their face. The immaterial beings analysis doesn't work because, once again, it makes us eliminativist because there's no space. And the material beings, the Lewisian view doesn't seem very attractive because it tells us we should identify the holes with the hole linings. But in this world, there is something that exists in exactly the region where we want to say the hole is, namely some material thing. And it seems like that thing is a better candidate to be identified with the hole than any hole lining could be. So we should think that in that world, the hole is some kind of material, albeit non-paradigmatic, not of the normal poke it kind of sense thing. Okay, because the Lewisian analysis misidentifies the whole. Moving on. There it is. So in actualist relationist non-plenum worlds, the Lewisian analysis is victorious because both of the other views make you eliminativists about unoccupied wholes. And in actualist relationist plenum worlds, the material beings view is victorious because the immaterial beings view makes you an eliminativist and the Lewisian view misidentifies them. Okay, so second world to consider, a world where metric field substantivalism is true. This world, W2, we're going to imagine is a plenum world, a world, and to make it a little bit like our world, it's a world where GTR holds. Okay. Now, according to the Vasi and Kasati view, we should be identifying the holes in this world with regions of substantival space. And here we have our space, so we're good to go. Now, the question arises, but are these in fact material or immaterial beings? After all, this is a plenum world, so all of the regions of space are qualified. So shouldn't we be thinking that we're actually what we're identifying is a material thing on their view? And they say, no, wait. We need to bring in this kind of modal criteria. So if it's the case that we could remove all of the quality, all of the matter from the relevant region and be left with the same space and the same whole, then we're in fact identifying the whole with an immaterial thing, not a material thing, because it merely turns out to be contingently occupied in this world. Now, this modal claim comes out quite differently under different accounts of substantival space. But in this particular case, metric field substantivalism, it actually looks like the Vasi and Kasati view is on firm footing at the moment, because there is a world, W2 star, which has numerically the same space as W2, except that the region occupied by the hole in W2 is unoccupied in W2 star. So W2 star is some non-plenum world with an unoccupied hole, and that unoccupied hole is in exactly the same region as the hole in W2. So it looks like their modal claim works and they can say, okay, in that world we have an immaterial being. But it's not quite so straightforward, because W2 star turns out to be not at all close to W2. It has very different laws of nature. So what we know is that given GTR, G the metric and T the stress energy tensor, that is the matter field, are interdependent. Because G includes is the gravitational field, so it includes various facts about the distribution of mass and energy. So what this means is that if you change the matter field, you change the metric. So what we want to do is think about the close worlds. These are all the worlds which have the same laws of nature. And now imagine we go to one of these close worlds and we consider that world where the matter has been removed from the relevant region where we want the hole to be. Then that turns out that must be a world that has a different matter field. So it must have a different metric. So by metric substantivalism, it must have numerically distinct space. Okay. So the point is that all of the nomologically accessible worlds from W2 are going to be worlds where if the hole is unoccupied, it's not the same space. So it's actually not the same hole at all. And this means that a whole raft of kind of completely plausible counterfactual conditionals will come out false. So if I remove the matter from where this hole is, the hole would remain unoccupied is false because you evaluated in the closest world, namely the world with the same laws of nature. But in those laws of nature, in the worlds that these nomological worlds with the same laws of nature, you have to change the matter field, you change the metric, you get numerically distinct space, you no longer have your hole. And that's a conditional that Vasi and Kasati clearly want to be committed to. Moreover, just perfectly ordinary conditionals like if I dug deeper, this hole would have been larger, will also be false for similar reasons. Okay, so this is problematic. In general, the material beings analysis isn't going to fare any better either. When you think of how the analysis goes in non-plenum worlds, the problem there is going to be that it's going to be eliminativist, because you'll get at least eliminativist with respect to any unoccupied holes. So it's not looking very good in those worlds. It does a little bit better in this particular world, the W2 world, because it's a plenum world. So it does correctly identify the whole, and it will get most of these ordinary counterfactuals right, because in the closest world with the same laws of nature, there is some material thing in the relevant region. It is the whole, and if you've dug deeper, it is larger. So those kind of counterfactuals will come out true. But notice why it does better. It does better because... I haven't actually told you what material beings are, but it does better because as I originally conceived them, I didn't do what Vasi and Casati suggest, which is straightforwardly identifying them with regions of qualified space. And that's a good thing, because there's lots of reasons why you don't want to do that. One is that you might think that even if you think substantivalism is true and necessarily so, you might well think that ordinary material things could have been composed of different space the same way you might think that they could have been composed of different matter. And given metric field substantivalism, you'd better think something like this, otherwise all the kinds of conditionals about material things will also come out dodgy, or at least some of them will. And also, it seems like you don't want your analysis of material beings to presuppose something about the nature of space. So you don't want to say that material beings just are regions of qualified space, because then it turns out that if relationism is true, actually, or in any worlds, then in those worlds there are no material things, but that's just clearly insane, right? So it seems obvious that if relationism is true at a world, what we want to say is that in those worlds maybe the material things are constituted by or contingently identical to some mereological sum of particulars or matter or something along those lines. And you could say something similar in substantival worlds, but for simplicity and parity with the Vasi and Casati account at the moment, we'll just say that if substantivalism is true in a world, then the material beings in that world are constituted by or contingently identical to some region of qualified space. And we'll go with contingent identity for simplicity, which is a view we're all familiar with. X and Y are contingently identical, just in case you have two terms which are co-referential in a world, but they sum up different counterpart relations, and the counterpart relations come apart in other worlds. Okay. But once we have this appeal to some kind of contingent identity for material objects, then it looks like you can pull the same fix for holes. You can say, well, holes are just contingently identical to regions of space, substantival space. So Vasi and Casati aren't going to have the problem of these bad conditionals because holes are contingently identical to different regions of space in different worlds, so it doesn't matter that the closest worlds with the same laws of nature will be worlds where we have numerically distinct space. It will just turn out that the hole in the relevant world, in this case W2, is identical to a different numerically distinct region of space in the world that we want to evaluate the conditional in. It doesn't matter that relevant world doesn't have the same space. So the idea is that you think of the totality of properties relevant to determining the location of whole, the H properties. And these include properties of topology, properties of the whole lining, various relational properties, and so forth. Then basically what we do is we track the counterparts of any whole by finding the counterpart of the object that has the whole in some world, and we find the whole lining there, and from there you can find the dimensions and the topology of the whole, and then you can determine with what region of space the whole in that world is contingently identical. And then you no longer have a problem with your counterfactuals. Oop. Okay. So what you would say in this case is that in any world in which there's metric field substantival space, a whole is contingently identical to the region of substantival space that has the H properties. So given that you have substantival space in a world, the whole is identical to the region of space that has the relevant properties, and then in some other world, the same, whatever the H properties are in that world, the whole will be the counterpart of the whole will be identical to some numerically distinct region of space. Okay, so that's a fix for the problem of counterfactuals if you buy some idea of constitutional contingent identity or something. These are the beginnings of this of a new analysis of this concept whole. And we've put it just in terms of identity. Our preferred reading is in terms of contingent identity, but for those who balk at contingent identity and are somehow prepared to bite some bullets about ordinary counterfactual claims about wholes, they can read this in terms of straight identity, and it won't fix any of your problems about counterfactuals, but it will fix some of your problems about misidentification and elimination in different worlds. So here are some plausible kind of conditional claims. If relationism is necessarily true, then necessarily wholes are identical to the material beings that possess the H properties, if there are any, and particular surfaces, whole linings of material beings otherwise. So this just tells us that if all your worlds are relationist worlds, then if you have a whole, and if the whole is an occupied whole, then yay, you have a material being that is that whole. And if you have a whole and it's unoccupied, then what you have is a whole that's identical to a whole lining. The second tells you that if metric field substantivalism is necessarily true, then wholes are identical to regions of metric field substantival space that possess the H properties, and necessarily so. So all wholes will be regions of substantival space, but given a contingent identity region reading, a whole and its various counterparts will be identical to different regions of substantival space. And the final two conditionals you can't really evaluate because I haven't talked about those kinds of space, but they have exactly the same form as the previous conditional. Even though those kinds of space do raise different sorts of problems for the different analyses, ultimately you get the same fix. So you get those two conditionals, which you can then collapse into this overarching kind of necessitarian analysis, which says that for any kind of substantivalism, if all of your worlds are worlds of that kind, K-worlds, then wholes are identical to regions of K-type substantival space that possess the H properties, and necessarily so. So if substantivalism of some kind or other is necessarily true, then all of your wholes are regions of substantival space, and necessarily so. Otherwise, wholes are identical to the material beings that possess the H properties, and to whole linings, if there are any, and to whole linings otherwise. Now, the point of this conditional is that there's nothing you can discover about the nature of space that forces you to be an eliminativist about wholes in general in some world. Rather, when you discover what account of space is the right one, you discover what the wholes actually are. So the discovery that relationism is true, it's a discovery, and necessarily so, isn't the discovery, as the Bazian-Cassati analysis would lead you to think, that actually, and counterfactually, there are no wholes. Rather, it's the discovery that occupied wholes are material beings and unoccupied wholes are whole linings. And that's consistent with it still being the fact that if it turns out that substantivalism is true and necessarily so, then wholes turn out to be regions of substantival space that possess the H properties. So the idea is that the analysis rescues you from misidentifying wholes. Well, it rescues you from eliminativism in this necessitarian kind of form. And it's then relatively easy to take into account the possibility, either real or epistemic, depending on where you fall on the necessity-contingency divide, that some of these accounts of space might be true or false in different worlds. So it seems like we want to say that for any world with substantival space, whatever kind of substantival space that is, the wholes in that world are identical to that kind of substantival space. That is, no particular kind of substantival space is a better candidate to be wholes than any other. And we want to say that in worlds where relationism is true, if you have a material being with the H properties, then that's your whole, and if you don't, then it's the whole lining. So that gives you this complete analysis one. For any world, if W is a world with substantival space of kind K, then the wholes in W are identical to regions of K-type substantival space that possess the H properties. Otherwise, wholes are identical to whichever material being possesses the H properties, if there are any, and otherwise to material whole linings. And the point is, once again, that this avoids any kind of elimination or misidentification, because it doesn't matter what the structure of logical space turns out to be. There are some conceptual priority built into it. So it tells us that in a relationist world, if you have something that possesses the H properties, of course it will be a material thing, then that's your whole rather than the whole lining. But basically it tells you that whatever your world is, you can find the whole in that world. So it tells you that necessarily, if relationism is true, then occupied wholes are material beings and unoccupied wholes are immaterial beings. And it tells you that necessarily, no wholes are immaterial beings. So it tells you that the immaterial beings analysis is, well, the claim that wholes are immaterial beings is necessarily false. But while the claim is necessarily false, it's not a conceptual truth, because the analysis is a conditional analysis. So the concept is still has this kind of conditional form, which tells you that it's still epistemically possible, albeit that you think that relationism is necessarily true, it's epistemically possible that some world out there has substantival space. And if you find that world, it won't turn out that there are no holes in that world. Rather, it will turn out that in that world, they are, the holes are the substantival space. And in exactly the same way, it turns out that if substantivalism is true and necessarily so, then necessarily no holes are hole linings, right? But once again, that's a necessary truth, but it's not in some sense a conceptual truth, because it's still true epistemically that if you were to discover a world where relationism is true, then you could easily have discovered a world where not where there are no holes, but where holes are hole linings. Okay, so as it stands, this analysis isn't sensitive to any facts about which world is the actual world. It's just sensitive to facts about which worlds turn out to be possible worlds. But you might think that you should be sensitive to which world is the actual world, because you might think some concepts are such that one candidate to be the extension of the relevant term is a significantly better deserver than any other candidates. So if that candidate turns out to be actual, then you want to rigidify on that candidate and say that all the worlds that don't have it don't have the relevant thing. And in this analysis, whole is just a straightforward kind of functionalist, non-rigid term. So we just get to say that wholes are identical in any world to whatever it is that has the H properties, if there is anything, and otherwise to a whole lining. And it doesn't matter which world is the actual world, right? But we might think that the analysis of wholes oughtn't to be like that. It ought to be sensitive to our world, because we might think that whole lining is just a paltry deserver, right? So we might think that if actually holes aren't whole linings, if we have a world with substantival space, or if we have a world that's a plenum world, then worlds where there's only whole linings aren't worlds with holes. They just lucked out. And so you might have some kind of conditional rigidification. You know, if actually the world is a certain way, then necessarily that thing is the referent of the term. And so there are various different ways you might conceptually prioritise what it would be, what the world would need to be like for that thing to be the best deserver. But here's probably the most plausible one, which is if actually there are entities that possess the H properties, then necessarily any whole is identical to an entity that possesses the H properties. Otherwise, wholes are identical to whichever entities possess the H properties, if there are any, or otherwise to whole linings. So basically, this tells you that if yours is a world where there is something that has H properties, then those things are wholes necessarily so. And in a world where there aren't entities with H properties, there are no wholes. But if actually it turns out there are no whole linings, there are no such entities with H properties, but there are only whole linings, then actually wholes are whole linings, and in other worlds, wholes are whatever have H properties or whole linings. So once again, this doesn't push you to any kind of eliminativism about the actual world wholes, but it does conceptually prioritise a particular world that the world could be, such that it can turn out that if wholes are that thing, then there are worlds where you're right to be a whole eliminativist. Okay. So, basically, in conclusion, what we want to say is that, look, what wholes are depends on these kind of controversial facts about the nature of space. And the problem for each of the three accounts as they stand is that either tacitly or explicitly, they build in some metaphysics into the actual analysis itself, which means that when you consider the analysis in worlds where the metaphysics doesn't hold, you end up misidentifying the wholes or eliminating them altogether, which is a bad thing. And I think the trick is to realise that our concept of whole only gives us guidance to what the nature of wholes are under various different presuppositions about what the nature of space is. And we think that there are sort of general lessons to be learned here, that the right process of developing an account of the nature of wholes is the process of developing some kind of conceptual analysis of the term. But that in itself is not some kind of straightforward matter. Rather, it's What it involves is considering all these different conditional claims about what you should say about the referent of whole under starkly different suppositions about the way a world could be, in some sense of could be. And then developing this kind of conceptual edifice which has built into it this map of all the various different conditional claims you might make, which tell you if there was a possible world like that, then that's the way, this is how the analysis could go, and this is what wholes would be. And ultimately think that this is all that can be done a priori. And what wholes, of course, turn out to be in terms of metaphysically just will depend on which part of the conceptual map represents logical space and possibly also which of those worlds is actual. And that involves some kind of further investigation, whether it's a priori or scientific. But all we can say a priori about the nature of wholes is what's built into this conceptual map. El finito. Right.
Would you agree that the holes can sometimes refer to just all possible holes, in which case the view seems less straightforward, at least?
So I guess that's better. So I guess there's two issues. One is an issue of kind of analysis. So when we're talking about holes sort of the concept, are we thinking of holes just in our world, or are we thinking about holes across all different worlds? And then there's the issue of when we're talking about holes at a world, are we just talking about the holes in that world, even regardless of what is the concept, or are we talking about kind of all the holes over all the worlds? And I guess I think these two things come apart. So the idea of the kind of conceptual analysis of whole is supposed to be one that ranges over all the worlds, at least in the typical sense in which we do conceptual analysis. So the idea is that you try and determine the intention of a term by reflecting on your kind of dispositions to pick out reference in various worlds considered as actual and counterfactual. And then you kind of equilibrate over those and you come up with something that you ultimately want to call the conceptual analysis or the intention or something which is a little bit similar to what Amy was talking about with application conditions. And that is something you arrive at by considering your dispositions in other worlds. So you do want to consider non-actual wholes. Then when you want to actually get your analysis, you want to think about what the wholes are, sort of what are my wholes here. So the analysis is supposed to tell you, it's supposed to be an analysis that will work in any world, so it sort of doesn't matter where you wake up, you look at your analysis, and the analysis should be right. Of course, what it spits out as being kind of the extension of whole in your world will depend on which world you've woken up in. So if you've woken up in a substantivalist world, then you sort of look, you consult your analysis and you find, yea, verily, wholes are regions of substantival space, and you go back to sleep. And you find yourself in, a relationist world, and you discover, no, they're actually whole linings. But you should be able to take your analysis from world to world, and it shouldn't matter what world you're in. But of course, your extension will change. And I guess that's the way I see the interplay between concept and extension and worlds. Does that answer the question? The intention, right, which is the kind of analysis
right.
is the intention, right.
Especially if you don't go with rigidification, if you think really
right.
in these
yep.
worlds where relationalism is true, the holes are there, the whole landings, and even though we know, assuming our world is not of this kind, still there are holes over there.
Yeah.
They're just the landings.
Right.
Then there is, it seems to me there is a sense in which it is false to say the holes are the regions.
Right, right. So, yeah, if by the holes you meant
right.
the entire class of extensions across all the worlds, then it's not true that the holes are... Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah.
Is this a hole here?
The analysis. No. Well, I think that what will begin to answer some of those questions will be whatever it is you build into the H properties. I mean, the H properties are supposed to be the things that, at least absent a case where you're worried about a hole lining, think about just the case of the H properties. Presumably, those are the kinds of things that are supposed to give you the individuation conditions for holes. So it's both supposed to tell you about the topology and the relational properties to objects and whatever else is packed into the H properties.
You mean I have to wait for some scientific development to answer the question?
No, I don't think it will be a scientific development.
No,
it won't be a scientific development because I don't think they give a toss. And I don't think it would matter if they did because it's not going to answer the question. I think the H properties, I mean, people have done some work on this, but I'm sort of presupposing some existing account or at least some account on its way that will, by talking about these H properties, will give you some idea of what the whole individuation conditions are and thereby what the same whole is. The overarching analysis is not really supposed to do that. That's a subpart of that requires that you have some account of exactly what counts in the H properties.
So you think that the other part of Quine's contribution to all this, apart from the B to be the value of a variable, has always been no entity without identity.
Right.
And I would take that to mean that if you've got a nominal expression and you're wondering whether, quantify, et cetera, et cetera, you've at least got to be able to answer the question, what counts as having the same one again, as opposed to having another one rather like it, so to speak, right? I mean, the count nouns in our language are supposed to be substantive in the sense that the things they range over are things about which we can always raise the question, are there more of them than of others? Is it the same one again, another one just like it? As far as I can see, I'm getting nowhere with hope.
Well, I mean, people have done various work on topology and on specifying this kind of thing. It's not obvious to me that there's anything any particularly... there's two issues. One is an issue of kind of holes across time. What makes a hole persist? When does it cease to be the same hole? Can holes be kind of punctate and come back into existence? And the other is a modal question about what other world, in which, in this class of worlds, which is the whole counterpart of this hole? Now, this analysis does tell you some things about whole counterparts because, it's we're contingently identifying holes with certain, regions of space or material things or whatever. And there will be facts about, what the relevant counterparts are. But as to the issue of sort of inner world, when is something the same whole? Well, I mean, sure, we don't have firm. Well, I don't know. I mean, Barzi and Cassati have a bunch of stuff about this in their book, but we don't. We might not have exact specifications of, you're the same hole just in case the following conditions hold, A, B, C, D, E, F. But I challenge anyone to provide that criteria for anything. I mean, it doesn't strike me that it's any more implausible. I mean, we do roughly track holes, and we do have perfectly good views about topology and dimension and stuff. And I don't see that there will be some objects where we have firmer views, so maybe like chairs or something, but there will be plenty of material things that seem to be just as unclear about exactly what the specifications for the identity conditions are. I mean, there's nothing for which we have a kind of laundry list of exactly what the conditions are. So if that's what's required to be kind of ontologically committed to something, I don't see that we should be really committed to anything. No, he may well be right. I just think that things have identity, just that we don't, just because we can't specify the exact conditions.
It sounds to me like with holes, we're doing a bit of a job. I mean, pretty easy with dogs and cats. I mean, whether this is the same cat I had yesterday or...
Well, I mean, people have an intuitive grasp on same cat. I don't know that anyone's ever written down exactly what it takes to be the same cat. No one's ever given me the kind of some biconditional X is the same cat if and only if, with a set of conditions according to which you're exactly the same cat. I mean, I'm a perfectly good cat tracker and I'm a perfectly good hole tracker. So I don't see that there's a disparity. I mean, I agree that holes have some more problematic... No, I think cats are evil psychopaths, so I don't actually buy into that. But that's not a problem of identity. It's not that I worry that I might, like, lose track of it because I don't know whether it's the same cat in that relevant sense. I couldn't say to the RSPCA, sorry, mate, I can't take a kitten, don't know about cat tracking. So I know, I agree I can track cats. But I can track holes too, in general. So...
That's my cat again, and that's that other cat that's the same kind of cat. And I'm just wondering about applying that ordinariness with respect to holes. Oh, yes, that's the hole he made yesterday. No, that's not that hole. It's another.
Well, people do that all the time, don't they? That's the same hole. That's the hole we made yesterday. That seems like a perfectly good sentence that you could... And there are different kinds of holes. There are holes, you know, there's a hole where you dig into something. There's a hole that goes, you know, straight through something. I mean, there are a whole range of different kinds of holes that you can specify topologically. It's just I'm not really into kind of micro coming up with different kinds of... Possibly, yeah. Yeah.
So I wasn't seeing why CA1, which you nicely have right here, met your own constraints on what it is to give an analysis, given that substantival spaces, you define it, and relationalism aren't exclusive. In particular, let me talk about two other possible views on space-time.
Oh, right, okay, I see. Yep. No, sorry, keep going.
That I don't think CA1 covers.
Right. Yeah.
One sort of view is what I think of as a version of substantivalism. But your definition of substantivalism was that space-time is independent of material objects. I don't think that's a good definition of substantivalism, because there's this view out there that something's called supersubstantivalism that identifies material objects with regions of space-time.
Right.
Actually, I think that's the natural reading of general relativity, is you've got a space-time manifold and a couple of fields living on it, no material objects in there. Your material objects just are regions of space-time that have null stress energy. In any case, if this supersubstantivalism doesn't count as substantivalism for you, then it's not clear how CA1 rules. There's also versions of anti-substantivalisms that aren't relationalisms. So in fact, Newton's own view, Newton's often classified as a substantivalist, at least early Newton, denied the space-time as substantival. He also, but his view of what space-time was an affectation of body. It's what happens when God creates body, God creates bodies for it to be placed, and that's and so space time is dependent on body. It's not a substance, but it's not defined by in terms of distance relations between bodies. Never mind that. Just consider a view. Imagine a view that's just a limit of us about material beings. So this view says that there are events.
Right.
So there's some sort of process.
Yeah.
And there's sort of distance relations between stages of processes as they unfurl.
Right.
And so it defines a space-time in terms of distance relations between stages of processes or something, and any event denies that, so it's non-self entitled, it denies that there are material beings or material whole linings. And so it seems like there's a lot of, at least epistemically, possible scenarios that CA1 doesn't cover.
Right, okay, so the first claim was that there's a view according to which material things are just identified with regions of space. And so I did have an intuitive gloss on substantivalism, which said that it's the view that, you know, you have your space independent of your objects and located where they are in virtue of blah, blah, blah. Once you get to pulling apart, so yeah, I probably shouldn't have said that as, you know, the definition of substantivalism per se, because once you start pulling apart the different kinds of substantivalism, then it becomes a live issue as to what the material beings are given that account. So especially when you have something like tensor field substantivalism, where your space-time is everything. And I mean, the big complaint with that view is supposed to be, but you've lost the distinction between kind of container and contained. Basically, it's to say that it doesn't quite entail that regions of space just are material, the relevant regions are material beings, or material beings just are, you know, regions of substantival space. But it's close. I mean, it's certainly a view that's very amenable to this claim that to be a material thing just is to be a particular region of space. So there is a point where I say, look, there are various ways you might cash out this idea of material things, and one of those ways is precisely to identify material beings with regions of substantival space, not qua analysis, but if you have substantival space, then of that world you might say that the material beings are the regions. Which makes the initial gloss of substantivalism misleading, because it is in terms of relations between things and space. So you're right, I should have been more clear there. But this CA1 is supposed to allow for that possibility, in the sense that when you say that the holes in this W are identical to regions of K-type substantival space that possess the H properties, if there are any. Now, these regions that possess the H properties might be material or immaterial, depending on how you cash out material or immaterial beings as an analysis, and which particular type of K-type space that is. So that first clause is supposed to be neutral on whether in your various worlds of substantival space, some of those holes, they'll be identical to the regions of space, but then it's a kind of further issue whether they're continually identical to immaterial beings or to material beings. But you're right, I did lead you astray at the beginning. As to the Newtonian placing of bodies, I'm having trouble getting my head around exactly what that amounts to. But the process. So I was a bit quick and dirty with defining relationism. I said, you know, it's objects, events, and primitive spatial and temporal relations. And you're right, and then I just went on to sort of drop the events, because I get sick of saying objects and events and just say objects. And so you're right, you could have a relationism that just has events. And then the analysis, you're right, so it technically, yeah, so there is that epistemic possibility, and so in those worlds they won't be material beings. There is an interesting question. I mean, in these relationist worlds where you've got sort of plenum world, so you've got material stuff in the relevant region that you want to identify with the holes, I'm calling it material beings, but of course they're not objects in the usual sense in which we refer to objects, any more than the kind of event in your event ontology is a kind of, in this relevant region, is a kind of usual event. And so it's true that strictly speaking, the analysis would need to change to say, you know, that In that relationist world, if what you have are events rather than objects, then your holes will be events. If there is an event with the, you know, H properties. So you're right that there is an epistemic possibility that I don't cover. I don't think it won't look terribly different, but yeah, I take the point.
Let me mention just another episode. I'm worried about this general demand of covering all the
answers. You think my analysis is going to be very unwieldy once I've covered all of
them? What about the following epistemic possibility? A mixed world that's substantivalist on the left, and then
that's a crap world. I don't like that world.
Drifts away and it goes relationalist on the right side of the
world. Right.
I mean, I don't think this is metaphysically possible, but, you've taught me to be modest about my implications of metaphysical
sensitivity. Right. So it seems like there should be a small tweak that can be made here, because, so we say, you know, in a world if you've got substantival space, then your holes are the substantival space. It seems like there should be a tweak we can make that will say, you know, where you've got substantival space in a world, your holes are that substantival space, and where you don't. So whatever the process is for talking cross-world, we ought to be able to come up with some fairly nice, swift way of rejiggering the analysis so that we can talk inter-world to cover these horrible cases of half substantival, half. But I gather that this is supposed to be going to a deeper point, namely that you can't cover all the epistemic possibilities, because once you start allowing in anything into the supposition, then there's too many things you have to cover, and you can't expect any. A, you can't expect any analysis to do it, and why should it? And B, it would be massively, rather than me wanting me to actually fix the analysis.
Yeah, and what are considered the epistemic possibilities for a dialetheist who thinks that a whole can be identical to both an immaterial whole and the lining at the same time? We don't need this, okay, you know, it's a contradictory implication.
I've never believed that thing about being both in and out of the door, I have to say. Graham just didn't convince me about that. I mean, maybe there are other instances, but I'm both in and out of the room as I pass through the door. Give me a break.
So maybe you want to say, well, don't be that modest about that.
Right,
but,
yeah.
I mean, it seems like this.
Where do you draw the line?
Well, let's be modest about what's metaphysically. Sorry, I sort of feel like.
Yeah. It's a fair point, and it is a point. So if you're going to draw the line, where do you draw it, and why shouldn't you draw it? If you're going to be kind of liberal, you can't be all the way liberal, so if you're going to draw it somewhere, why not just draw it at the boundaries where you think that the possible worlds really are? Why start thinking about epistemic possibilities at all, given that at least that's a kind of non-arbitrary place to draw it, namely, I think this is all impossible. And that, yeah, that's a fair, I guess I need to think about that a bit more. Maybe it's something to do with the distribution of credences. So, I mean, initially the motivation was kind of, yeah, but you should give reasonable credence to some of these other hypotheses. And I guess the further out you're going to the kind of weirder and weirder worlds where you've got, you know, half substantivalism, half relationism, your credences are becoming very low that's going to be a possible world, and certainly that you've got to find yourself in that world. Whereas your credence that some kind of relationism might be true, really, if you're a substantivalist, shouldn't be too bad, because, I mean, you know, even people in physics really fall on both sides of this line. I mean, they do seem like they're both live options. So maybe there's some sort of story about you have to be a little bit liberal, otherwise you're constructing analysis that's really, it's leaving you wide open to elimination, but you don't want to be so liberal that you're trying to let in everything. And I haven't given this enough thought.
Okay, there's a couple of follow-ups. The first one.
Yeah, quick thing, Christy. Maybe following on from what Jonathan said about event-based ontologies. If we have an event-based world, then would it help to distinguish between wholes and non-wholes by saying that a whole in an event-based ontology is actually just a space where there's nothing going on, rather than a whole being some kind of whole with a whole line? You now have event boundaries, and you have areas or regions of your space where there's just nothing going on. And then you don't have this spatial problem of, well, is there anything there or isn't there?
Yeah.
We will get into trouble if we try to conflate the notions of things and events. If we got entities and events and mixed them all up, then we said, okay, well, there's no events here, but there's still entities.
Right.
But if we are driving a purely event-based ontology, a whole would just simply be a region where there's nothing going on.
Okay, so let's suppose we've got a pure event ontology. Some holes might be places where there are no events. So So what I'm calling unoccupied holes will be regions that are eventless. But there could equally be holes where there are events. So plausibly ours is a world where there are events everywhere. Suppose ours is an event ontology world. And in fact, no, Jez, it does events, things happening. It seems like there's a, well, at least there's a certain, there's certainly a possible world that is an event ontology world, but
which
where
is still a plenum.
Yeah, but which is a plenum world. And in those worlds the holes will be events of some kind or other. Rather than, well, that they won't be regions of eventlessness. In an event ontology world, the analysis will look exactly the same as CA1, except that in relationist worlds you'll be identifying your occupied holes with a certain kind of non-paradigmatic event rather than a certain kind of material being, and your unoccupied holes with event linings. I don't know what an event lining is, but if you have an event ontology, presumably you have some story that will translate ordinary talk into event talk. I mean, presumably there has to be something which is the analog for a hole, for a normal hole lining, will be the event hole lining. Or so I think it will look exactly the same, but we'll be talking about events instead of material things. So it's no more problematic and it's no less problematic, it seems.
This might be too obvious, but just comment in relation to a dialectic hole. You might have something that's disintegrating, and at what point does it cease to be a hole, and then the dialectic is resolved?
It's both a hole and not a hole at time t. Yeah, you've got to love those dialethists. Right. So I don't consider that possibility, that the worry that there are things that are both holes and not holes. I don't know what I would... I mean, I guess my intuition is that sometimes it's vague at what point something's a hole. I'd say that. And I guess then apply your normal account, whatever your preferred account of vagueness is, which could be some thing according to which... it's both a whole and not a whole. It could be some kind of, glutty truth value thing as opposed to a gappy solution, which will give you both whole and not whole. I guess everything I've said sort of assumes that there are determinate facts about holes at any time, or it doesn't buy into those kind of worries. Maybe I do need to say something about, indeterminacy with respect to holes.
Just leading into the idea that maybe you do have to be open-minded about
dialethics. Oh, I see. That would be a reason to... Yeah, I don't think it requires that you be a dialethist, because, I mean, for almost anything, there is some point at which it looks like it's kind of indeterminate whether the thing still exists or not. Remove enough stuff from any particular object and there'll be a point at which it's not clear if it's, the same thing or not. And so if that kind of sorieties problem may mean that we all had to be dialethists, then... everyone would be a dialethist. So it seems like there is some alternative answer to that problem, but I take the point that I haven't, whatever that alternative is, I haven't said anything about it, and maybe that is something I should have thought more about.
Any more? No? Okay, so let's thank Christy.